Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Today on Truth and Movies, one of the final films from legendary actor Harry Dean Stanton, the heartfelt drama Lucky.
It was the saddest moment in my whole life.
And then The Hunt has evolved, or has it? It's Shane Black's sci-fi action throwback, The Predator.
Tell me about the mission. Did you see anything unusual?
And for Film Club, Robert Downey Jr. and Val Kilmer star in Shane Black's first directorial effort, Kiss Kiss Bang Bang.
Well, what I'm doing, for the guy who likes to bluff, is I'm playing a little game called Am I Bluffing? Huh?
Stick around. It's Truth in Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. Yes, it's Truth in Movies, the podcast that reviews the week's new releases for those of you who ain't got time to read. I'm Michael Leader, and this week I'm joined by Little White Lies Grand Fromage, David Jenkins.
Hey there.
And Little White Lies contributor, Matt Thrift.
Hi.
Welcome, guys. How are we feeling today?
Good.
Good. It's bright and cold, which is a combo that I like, actually.
It's a good combo, but yeah. The important question is, are we feeling lucky? That's the first film of the week, Harry Dean Stanton starring
Do
in Lucky.
Do we get lucky?
Well, we'll have to see, won't we? Let's kick on. So Harry Dean Stanton stars in Lucky, something of a character sketch of a 90-year-old man smoking and drinking his way through his old age, following him on his spiritual journey in rural California. The film is directed by actor-turned-director John Carroll Lynch and was co-written by Logan Sparks, who was Harry Dean Stanton's long-term assistant and friend. Here's a clip.
When I was a kid living in Kentucky, I had this BB gun that didn't shoot straight. So I was out one day shooting at things, trees, leaves. And there was a mockingbird up in a tree singing its heart out. And I aimed my gun just to scare him away, pulled the trigger, and the singing stopped. It was the saddest moment in my whole life.
Harry Dean Stanton there. Lucky, he's guessing its release over here almost a year to the day that he passed away in September 2017. David, is this a fitting tribute for the long-term character actor?
I think so. I mean, I got to say, I approached the film with a sort of element of trepidation. I think it was at Sundance, like, about a year and a half ago, where it got its world premiere. And it looked to me from the outset a little bit quaint. It looked like a kind of very sunny American indie film of a very certain type. And it was like, oh, it feels like this is some young director who's got their hands on Harry Dean Stanton because they love Repo Man or something and have just sort of have him wandering around and don't really understand him. But actually, I was completely, the reality is not that at all. Mm. John Carroll Lynch is someone who's worked with Harry Dean Stanton it before on screen, and there's this real kind of empathy and understanding about what you have with him as an actor. And the film itself is this very kind of rootsy, low slung, quite sort of poetic, a bit like kind of Raymond Carver, these very sort of little sort of evanescent stories of like everyday life, just following this guy around his daily routine. He's ornery and he sort of shouts at people, but then he has these little stories. You know, when you kind of eventually break him down, he has these little stories that he tells, like in the clip there. It's a really lovely performance. I think it could maybe feel slight to some people because it is just so focused on character and so focused on a guy maybe sort of contemplating his existence. But it doesn't sort of force that in your face. It does it in a very kind of like relaxed and charming way, I'd say. It's him just wandering around. He goes to the bar. He'll go to the convenience store and have a chat to people. He goes to a fiesta. Mm-hmm. It feels very autobiographical in that sense. One of the things I remember reading about Harry Dean Stanton is, actually, it was a friend of mine told me that he was in L.A. I think he was at a party for, it was like Dazed and Confused were having a party in L.A. and this was in the 90s. And he turned around and Harry Dean Stanton had just sort of walked into it. And he was just chatting with these young kids who I'm not sure they even knew who he was, but he was this old guy and he was just standing there with a drink and a cigarette. And it's like that thing that you hear that Bill Murray does. You know how Bill Murray just like...
Turns up
at parties. Yeah. Apparently, it feels like something very unselfconscious about it. He just wanted to go and meet people and enjoyed talking to people and wanted to have a good time rather than like... I think the Bill Murray thing does feel like a kind of building his own personal mythos. So this film feels like, you know, feels very honest.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's where Logan Sparks, the co-writer, comes in, isn't it? He, you know, knew Harry Dean Stanton. He's quite a relatively young guy, but worked with Harry Dean Stanton for a decade or so. And I'd recommend reading Q&As or interviews with him because he's full of stories and all of that that intimacy with Harry Dean Stanton, the actor, that went into creating this fictional film that, for me, is great at depicting later old age. He's 90, so he is just a creature of routine and habit and just goes about his daily existence, but then can still have this profound change in his spiritual worldview. Matt, was this slight or profound for you?
Well, I mean, I think that kind of slightness is pretty deceptive. Mm-hmm. I mean, as David mentioned Raymond Carver, and I think this really does have the kind of structure and control of a really good short story. Mm. And I think there's a lot more going on. I think John Carroll Lynch is doing a lot more than perhaps immediately meets the eye. And I think to go through these everyday small moments and to string them all together and have it sort of feel like more than the sum of its parts by the end of it is I think, kind of testament to his skill as a director. And I think he really avoids, one of the traps I often find with when you watch an actor turned director's film. And this, I don't really how to say it. I mean, it has the sort of monologuing moments. It has the sort of actory showcase bits, Harry Dean Stanton singing a song at a fiesta, which is just beautiful. But they're really controlled and they're really understated and they really feel kind of earned.
It's quite unsentimental film.
Yeah.
It's a film that looks from every angle that is like it's going to be this kind of sentimental homage, but it never really does that.
And I think he does something almost quite brilliant with David Lynch, who plays a character in the film, a friend of, a kind of barfly mate of Harry Dean Stanton's, where it starts off with him doing the sort of Lynchy weirdness that you perhaps were expecting, but then kind of doubles down on it and undercuts it entirely, where, you know, you start off by perhaps laughing at this man who's sad that his tortoise has run away from him. But then it becomes a really kind of quite moving little scene about loss and acceptance that's kind of sums up really what the whole film's about as well. And yeah, quite moving, I thought.
It was so good to see David Lynch acting in a film that wasn't his own piece of work, really. And that is testament to how the relationship between Harry Dean Stanton and David Lynch, they've worked in many films together. I do find it interesting that John Carroll Lynch directs this, no relation to David Lynch.
Yeah.
And of course, John Carroll Lynch, as an actor, he's such a familiar presence. He's the husband in Fargo, for example, and he's been in so many other
Zodiac
films.
Zodiac killer, yeah.
Or was he? How was David Lynch for you, David?
Oh, yes, delightful.
I mean, his beautiful cream suit and hat.
Yeah, his tortoise, President Truman.
Roosevelt.
President Roosevelt. Sorry. Wrong president. He was great, but I don't necessarily feel that, like, I would sort of single him out as, like, the best thing in the film. And that is to say that I think all the small parts in the film are really nicely cast. And even some characters who are on the screen for, like, 2 or 3 minutes, it feels like they get, you know, a lot of value, a lot of character shading. All the other kind of barfly characters as well. It does feel like a kind of Cheers at the End of the Night kind of vibe, you know.
Well, there's Tom Skerritt, has a quite small role as well, almost unrecognisable because I can't remember the last time I saw him in a film, but reuniting with Harry Dean Stanton after Alien, after all these years, you know, 40 years on.
Yeah, they have a lovely little kind of scene in the cafe talking about, they're both war veterans from Second World War.
Yeah.
So they have some war stories to share, and you know they sort of have this mutual respect for each other, which kind of comes over. But again, it's not really, it's never a sort of feels sort of jingoistic or anything. Mm-hmm. In fact, you know, Harry Dean Stanton's character Lucky is very honest about his feelings about the war, and it's not necessarily triumphalist or positive and or nostalgic even. So,
do you think this film would play to people who don't already have a relationship with Harry Dean Stanton through his films throughout the years?
I mean, there are certainly films of this kind which really do play on the sort of celebrity nature or the your perceptions of that particular actor or celebrity. But I think this is much more kind of honest than that. And of course it does play into, and it's impossible to separate seeing this last year, you know, when he just died. It's impossible to kind of pull those things apart. Mm-hmm. But I think absolutely.
It's not played with any kind of irony. You know, the David Lynch character, you kind of think, oh, here we go, wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Mm-hmm. But then the great thing about it is that it does transcend that very quickly. Mm-hmm. And he actually is playing it with a very straight bat in the end.
Yeah.
And you know, it actually makes the film feel all the more kind of powerful.
Where would we say this would sit for Harry Dean Stanton's canon? Is this a fitting send-off for him as an actor, as a figure?
Let's see. I mean, just looking at his IMDb the other day, I mean, there's over 200 credits there. And yet I was kind of struggling to think of more than a handful of leading roles that he's played. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I mean, I guess the most substantial one before this was Paris, Texas. Mm-hmm. And that's what? 35 years ago or something, 30-odd years ago.
So it's a fitting send-off to have him at the centre of a film, I suppose. Yeah.
Absolutely, yeah. It's a rare bird to see Harry in the middle of things. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think it's a really lovely little sort of send-off.
This seems like a great opportunity to pick our favourite Harry Dean performance, if there is one. Anything that comes to mind, Matt? Would be Paris, Texas, for example.
Yeah, I mean, that monologue scene in Paris, Texas is one for the ages, but, I mean, God, Repo Man as
Repo
well.
Repo Man would be the one for me.
Dave. I think he's good in Alien. I mean, it's a small role in Alien, but he's just... I like the idea that Harry Dean Stanton is somehow in space. I think his death is the best death scene, apart from maybe John Hurt. But that's obviously like on a slightly different level to things. But I always remember really enjoying his death scene. So
should we give Lucky some scores? David, would you like to go first? So
yeah.
This is in anticipation, enjoyment in retrospect.
So I love Harry Dean, but I was a bit, you know, looking at the kind of glossy yellow poster for the film, I was thinking, oh God, it's like an American indie sentimental thing. And so I'd maybe go for like 2 or 3. Mm-hmm. Let's say 2. No, 3, because I love Harry Dean Stanton. And then, 4 and 4 for enjoyment in retrospect. It was just, you know, lovely, you know, just caught me off guard.
Mm. Matt?
Yeah, I think pretty much the same. I mean, it certainly had a sort of whiff of Sundance tweeness or slightness about it going in, but it completely disarmed me really quickly. And, yeah, I think 4s. 4s all the way. And I'd like to see John Carroll Lynch's next movie as well.
Right. So that was Lucky, on release this week. We mentioned Alien there, and up next, we're going to talk about one of Alien's greatest enemies, the Predator, after this short break.
Do you know what my job description is? I'm in acquisitions. I look up, and I catch what falls out of the sky.
Tell me about the mission. Did you see anything unusual?
It's above our pay grade.
Do I get a cookie now?
Look, I get it. Something went down in Mexico. Nobody wants any witnesses.
We need to know if you and your men pose a threat.
We're Rangers.
Yes, so that's the trailer for The Predator. A sequel/reboot/revamp from Shane Black. Matt, was this a necessary sequel and does it make a case for itself?
So Shane Black obviously famously was the first one to be killed as an actor, wasn't he, in the first Predator movie back in the 80s. And he's joined that, it must be quite a small club of subsidiary cast members of franchises that have then gone on to direct. So I guess that means dinner at Jonathan Frakes' house once a year.
Oh yeah, with Lee Whannell.
I think it's quite interesting to know that this is definitely a sort of collaborative effort between Shane Black and his mate Fred Decker.
Mm.
Because it almost felt more like a Fred Decker movie in many respects.
So Fred Decker.
Fred Decker, who made Night of the Creeps and The Monster Squad, most famously, before disappearing after
RoboCop 3. So this is his first produced kind of screenplay in like 20 years.
Yeah. I mean, the two of them apparently, I've not seen it, but apparently collaborated on a TV thing a couple of years ago, like a pilot that didn't make it to series. And yeah, Shane Black. It's not really very good. I mean, it's... I didn't think it was as kind of quite as terrible as some of the notices that have been coming out. I mean, I thought it started quite strongly. And I do have some time. I mean, we're going to talk about Kiss Kiss Bang Bang afterwards. And I do have a bit of time for Shane Black's kind of casually cruel, sadistic irreverency.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether it goes a little bit too far in places, whether this is, you know, just... Well, it's just not really funny enough, not really action-packed enough. Not really cruel enough, or I mean, everything just kind of feels a little bit neutered, a little bit flat.
Mm-hmm.
The basic setup of this one is that we've got the pack of commandos, except this time they're straight out of the cuckoo's nest.
Mm-hmm, mm.
So they call themselves, I think, the Loonies in the film, is that right?
Yeah, they're on the Loony bus.
Yeah, and Predator comes to suburbia and finds himself up against these loonies and a little
ex-military.
All ex-military.
Kind of PTSD afflicted.
And
a biology teacher who's along for the ride.
A sort of Snow White to their seven dwarves. I mean, yeah, Shane Black really still, I think, struggles with female characters.
He struggles with female characters. He struggles with mental health character details.
Yeah.
There's also an autistic kid that's played by Jacob Tremblay from Room, who is at one point posited as the next step on the evolutionary chain, which is sort of used to almost excuse the fact that it's just depicting of autism is Rain Man, basically.
It's wantonly offensive. but no, I think with this film, like dealing with its kind of being willfully offensive, my take on it, and I know this is probably not a good thing to say, but it's like when the stupid kid says something stupid, you're kind of like, well, you know, it's what can you do? I don't think this film ever is operating on a level where you think that, oh, this is going to give me a serious survey of mental illness. You know, it's like he kind of uses it for the purposes of a screenplay rather than of a psychological analysis.
I mean, I have no problem with the sort of willful political incorrectness. But just if it was a little bit funnier or was just kind of skewering something, or just the gag rate in this movie for a sort of action sci-fi horror is ridiculously high. But the amount of them that actually land with any kind of wit or charm, even in their, you know, stupidity, is pretty low.
I think I maybe like this a little bit more than you.
I didn't hate it.
I definitely agree that it was trash. And there was almost like this impulse that he was actually trying to make something trashy, that he was trying to make, like, he was trying to sort of almost suppress his own impulse to, like, make it seem too good or too funny or have too many kind of ironic zingers or too many references. There were lots of references to the other films. But it was almost like there was this 80s video rental shop, nasty film on the top shelf, that as a kid, you'd be looking at the kids section, but your eyes would be wandering over to the video art, the really kind of gory video art.
Mm-hmm.
And I almost saw this as a sort of film that I think I would have probably loved to have seen this as a kid. Its kind of obvious deficiencies wouldn't have registered. And, you know, I think I'd have just liked the idea of like a predator running around. And it's almost like, I don't know, someone's told him you have to make this 50% crapper because this can't be a kind of well-written, thoughtful Shane Black movie, not thoughtful is really the wrong word, but like, you know, a film like The Nice Guys at least has a sort of like, you know, there are sort of chess pieces moving around the board, and there's a feeling that he has an idea of what's happening, whereas this, it kind of gets to a point where it's just like logic flies out the window, and it's like the people turning up to fights around, you know, who you're like, how did that person get, you know?
That creates the issue where does anyone go to Shane Black for action or schlock or horror or gore? And that's something he's not really done as a filmmaker.
But he's shown a keen sense and a keen awareness of genre in a general sense, you know, from the sort of massive excesses of Last Action Hero and, you know, writing the book on buddy comedy with Lethal Weapon, and then the sort of deconstructions of Nice Guys and Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. And this, I just, I was, you know, going in expecting a Shane Black take on that action horror, you know, that he's so indelibly twinned with because of his role in the first film. It kind of flirted with all of these things and just didn't really feel like it was nailing much of them for me.
I thought the action scenes were the sort of weak point of the film. And I know that's probably a big weak point for a film.
It's an action movie.
That is an action.
The CGI gore as well, just atrocious.
It all felt quite cheap on that side of things. Mm. And especially, like, because, I mean, I've seen that many times, but I took the opportunity to revisit the John McTiernan original. And there's a thing that he does, and it's just such a simple thing. It's almost like a kind of directorial motif. I don't know if you guys remember it, but the film is set in the jungle, and it's this commando unit, and they're kind of standing off against the predator, who is kind of picking them off one by one. And what he does is just, he has this thing where he just, when there's going to be a big reveal, he'll kind of run his camera along a vine or slowly up a tree, and you're like waiting. And sometimes it'll make you wait like 45 seconds to actually see that what is at the top of the tree or what is at the end of the vine. And it's just these little things that actually build a sense of tension, almost like you're sort of slowly opening your eyes to something. And Shane Black just does not. I mean, whether that is like he's had someone over his shoulder in the editing room saying, no, we need this to be faster, we need this to be quicker, we need to be more to be happening, we need to get more actors on the screen, we need to get more dialogue. There's no sense of like, let's just take a breath. Let's just hold this moment. You know, the whole concept of the predator is like you can't see it. So it's like you're in a room, there is something else there and you don't know it's there. Mm-hmm. And that concept is missing from this new film.
I mean, this is the third Predator sequel. You know, with each installment, I think every director that's had a go at it seems to still be struggling in a way that McTiernan wasn't, with what the Predator actually is and what its MO is. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Shane Black's answer seems to be in this one, let's make a bigger one and give him some dogs.
Yeah.
I thought that, like, yeah, if that's the extent of their...
I mean, there's quite a funny bit at the beginning that they do a couple of, you know, where this kind of trying to define what a Predator is, and it's like, well, it's not actually a Predator, it's a, you know,
it's
more of a bass fisherman.
Yeah.
Which is...
One of the other things that I really missed, again, I haven't seen the second sequel... The Nimrod and Tal.
Predators. I think that's such the hidden gem of the
Predators. Okay. Oh, God, maybe I need to visit.
No, you're not a
fan. I watched it again. No.
Oh, did not stand up.
I think it's just totally worth it for Lawrence Fishburne's just Looney Tunes performance, where he's really going all out. But
So you can tell me then if it has this, because like the first two, the Predator's trophies are like the skulls of his kills. And in his little kind of Swiss Army amulet thing that he has, one of the sort of items in there is a sort of valet steam cleaning setup, where I think it's in the second one specifically that you see him like... Actually, no, I think in the first one as well, you see him pull out this little kind of steam cleaner and sort of basically like steam off the flesh from one of the skulls and then buff it. So he's, you know, it's creating this lovely clean skulls for him to take back. I was hoping that there was going to be a buffed skull in the new one. And, you know, I don't know if this counts as a spoiler, but if you're going to the new Predator to see some skull buffing...
Little interest in the Predator's hygiene protocols in this one.
I mean, it makes sense. If you're taking skulls back to another planet, you're going to want to prepare them in a way that, you know...
They're presentable.
And they're not going to cause a smell on the ship. You know,
maybe next time.
Yes.
Maybe the next sequel or spin-off or prequel or whatever will come next.
I did think Trevante Rhodes, who I think, I guess, was last biggish role was in Moonlight.
The eldest one in Moonlight.
He's really great in this film. And it was one of those sort of supporting roles where you're thinking, why wasn't he the main guy kind of thing? Boyd Holbrook's quite good as a sort of, you know, flinty, single-trait action hero, but... Yeah,
Thomas Jane has fallen fourth supporting,
quite deep in the ensemble. Yeah. Lumbered with a sort of Tourette's character trait that doesn't never
really
pays
doesn't
off.
Land,
Keegan-Michael Key as well is in there in the ensemble, and you'd expect him to maybe be a little bigger, but only I'd say only Trevante Rhodes comes out of it well.
I thought the villainish character,
Sterling K. Brown,
was
last name of the Black Panther, I believe,
wasn't bad.
Yeah,
and Jacob Tremblay. He seems to play roles now where he's a very kind of small boy, like physically small, one of the things that happens in his movies is like, let's get Jacob Tremblay to wear a big hat or a big helmet. Because he was in that film Wonder.
Yes.
Where he had a kind of facial deformity and was and would walk around in a big space helmet. And that was and
our generation's mask, wasn't it?
Indeed. And in this one, there's a shot of him in, you know, he happens across the Predator mask. And there's a sort of, isn't that juxtaposition hilarious? It's little and Jacob Tremblay in the Predator mask.
Well, for Shane Black fans, this is not set at Christmas, this is set at Halloween.
But Shane Black's got a pretty, I think, does a pretty good irreverent line in from Iron Man 3 and The Nice Guys, and then this in kind of Sweary Kids.
Yes. Although this one didn't...
He does at the end. He has, he has a moment, doesn't he?
Of course.
He gets his moment.
Yeah.
Is this our moment to put scores on this film, I think? Matt, do you want to go first?
Three. You know, new Predator movie, new Shane Black movie. Definitely wanted to have a look. And twos. I mean, twos, yeah. I mean, I didn't hate it. I was perfectly entertained, only occasionally annoyed. Mm-hmm. And if I stumbled across it at 11 o'clock on telly after the pub on Friday night, I'd probably watch 40 minutes of it again.
David?
Probably go a bit higher in enjoyment, so 3-3-2 for me. It's one of those films where I think its saving grace is that it's maybe a little bit better than some other similar types of films by maybe directors who have got their kind of full level hack on. Mm-hmm. Whereas I think at least with this one, there is a little bit of extra value there. There is a bit of sort of the Shane Black touch that's visible. So for me, that feels, the film works a little bit better for me.
But not on the same scale as the original.
Oh, God, no. I mean, the original's really good. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like, it's a, you know, McTiernan, when he in his pomp, was quite something.
And even Predator 2? Where does this rank
alongside that? Predator 2 is really bad. Yeah. They just threw so much money at it. And yeah, it's awful. Yeah.
It's Predator in the City, and it just doesn't work.
Danny Glover looking really confused.
Well, so that was The Predator. Up next, we're sticking with Shane Black with his directorial debut for Film Club, Kiss Kiss Bang Bang.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So Dexter had Veronica killed, threw a dress on her, dumped the body, and walked away clean, except for one little thing.
Underpants.
One tiny little pair of undies.
Yeah.
You think that's funny, huh? I'm gonna break your nose now. Okay. Oh! I want you to picture a bullet inside your head. Can you do that for me?
F*** you. Anyway, that's ambiguous.
Ambiguous? No, I don't think so.
No, I think he means that when you say picture it inside your head, okay, is that a bullet will be inside your head or picture it in your head? Like
Carrie,
form an image.
Shut up?
He's got a point. I don't know anything about a girl, seriously. I was bluffing. You know what? I think that you are bluffing right now.
Harry, what are you doing?
Well, what I'm doing for the guy who likes to bluff is I'm playing a little game called Am I Bluffing? Huh? Where is she? Where the f*** is Harmony?
Harry.
You
want
to play hardball? I can do that. Where is the girl?
What?
did you just do?
I put in one bullet, didn't I?
You put a live round in that gun.
Oh, yeah. There was like an 8% chance. 8%? Was that just
8? 8?
Yeah.
Who taught you math?
More? I don't know.
That's Robert Downey Jr. there, and Val Kilmer in Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. Downey Jr. is a crook who finds himself cast in a movie, sent out to Hollywood, and paired up with Kilmer's private eye for some detective training that goes awry. This came out 13 years ago now. So much has changed since then for both Shane Black, Downey Jr. and Val Kilmer, in fact. David, what's it like revisiting this film now?
Well, I've got to say, for me, it wasn't a revisit. I'd never actually seen it before. Last week was my sort of first viewing of it. Mm-hmm. It's interesting because it's always kind of one of those films that is a lot of people like, mm-hmm. but it's never really held up or talked about that often. It's a film that made me feel very old.
In what sense?
In the even though it was from 2005, it felt like it was from another era. It just felt so kind of the world has moved on from this film. And maybe I'm sort of talking politically. It's very un-PC in quite a sort of Lucian Lively way. Mm-hmm. This is Downey Jr.'s, I believe it's his kind of comeback film. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's that idea that I feel old is because he is basically sort of formulating that the shtick that he has basically gone on to make billions of dollars with, mm-hmm. with through Iron Man, even with Shane Black in Iron Man 3. It just felt like that the whole kind of winking to the camera, and it has Downey Jr. is the narrator of the film, and he keeps constantly breaking the fourth wall and referring to the actual artifice of the film itself and the narrative, and it's very, very, very kind of self-conscious, backslapping, mm-hmm. quite often very amusing film that just seems so weird. Like I was just like, wow, this film is like so strange. I mean, there's not really been anything like it since that's mm-hmm. really sort of pushed things to that level. It almost feels like a kind of someone said to him, do what Charlie Kaufman has been doing with being John Malkovich, an adaptation, but in a way that's a bit more mass market that we can do something with, mm-hmm. you know. We don't care about Oscars for this one. We want, like, money. So. Yeah.
What struck me is how almost unrepentant it is. This is 9 years after Shane Black's previous produced screenplay, which was Long Kiss Goodnight, and after that run of bloated films that were box office bombs, Last Action Hero and so on. You'd think he would have maybe softened his approach in some way, but this one is such an overwritten screenplay. The idea of the narration, the idea of saying, that was a bad scene, don't worry, it'll come back later on. It's such a self-aware film. And now, just seeing where he's gone as a filmmaker and, you know, seeing certain characteristics, the fact that he's so interested in film noir and still interested in buddy relationships and so on. But it's so fascinating to see that right out of the gate, he's saying, this is me, this is Shane Black. You can't mistake me for anyone else.
And that's it. I think, you know, for all intents and purposes, this should be smug and annoying, and it is completely overwritten. But I just think it really gets by on sort of force of personality, mm-hmm. both of Downey Jr. and Kilmer, kind of mm-hmm. front and center, but also Shane Black. I mean, he is throwing everything at the wall just to see what kind of sticks. And, you know, a lot of it does. It's just delivered with such kind of confidence and, I guess, wit. And, I mean, I think it does that thing as well that Scream does really mm-hmm. well, in that if you're going to make a sort of meta larky genre deconstruction, you really have to understand the nuts and bolts of the genre that you're deconstructing. And, you know, what Scream does brilliantly is take the piss out of a horror movie while also giving you a pretty solid horror movie at the same time. And I think this, for the most part, does, you know, take apart all of the screen conventions and novelistic conventions of Raymond Chandler, mm-hmm. you know, potboilers, while giving you one at the same time that, you know, is reasonably successful. But it's just got this barreling force of personality that carries you through the sort of nonsensical plot twists. And there are some really, really funny moments.
It is genuinely funny, but also genuinely quite un-PC at times. Watching this again now, the Gay Perry character that Val Kilmer plays with a sort of camp lisp all the way through is a bit on the line. And then the use of, later on, of sort of sexual domestic abuse as a plot point that's sort of just thrown in the mix. It's, looking back now, as you say, a bit dated, David.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it looks quite quaint now, I think. I mean, like, Kilmer's obviously, like, as well in his kind of character research developed what looks like a kind of his take on a gay walk, which is a sort of like, you know, a sort of weird shuffle slightly kind of hip-shaking shuffle. And that kind of stuff, you just sort of like, you know, you're sort of face-palming.
But I think more uncomfortable is the fact that it's Downey Jr.'s character's subjectivity throughout the whole thing. You know, he's narrating and effectively the lead character. And so you're with him in his kind of disgust and distaste of...
Yes.
Val Kilmer's gayness, you know, making a joke of him kissing him and so on. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where it got a little uncomfortable.
I guess, yeah.
But then he's an idiot. But then he's an idiot at
yeah,
the same
exactly.
time, which kind
you,
of
you have an obnoxious relate. You know, that actually sort of like makes it a less bitter pill in a way, in that it is like subjective viewpoint. And that, yeah. you know, if he is homophobic, then.
And it is quite equal opportunities offensiveness. Yes. I mean, it's, yeah.
It's doubtful we'll ever see a film of its type again. And I mean, like now, when a film comes out and it's sort of dunked into the crucible of social media, and there is a sense of like, does this film pass, not pass certain tests, but, you know, what kind of political talking points does this film have? I think, you know, if this film had come out now, I mean, it would have just been torn to shreds, I think. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's the talk of its un-PC-ness would sort of swamp the quality of the screenplay and the sort of meta self-referential element of it. Yeah, but I agree with you there. It's really good in that idea of it's of the deconstruction of the sort of knowing side of things. It's less good in the actual plot that it's trying to sort of offer you at face value, the sort of fun detective plot, twisty detective plot. Gets to a slight point of incoherence where, like, maybe like two thirds in, I'd sort of lost the plot. Someone's father's killed someone who looks like someone who, you know, and I was like, I'm just going to switch off now. And by the end, where you've got these kind of quite earnest kind of honor killings to wrap things up. Why are we here?
But then, yeah,
maybe that's me. I don't know.
It's just those the little moments that make it for me. It's, you know, it's not so much Robert Downey Jr. urinating on a corpse. It's him explaining it to Val Kilmer in the next scene, just trying to
Or even the clip, as we heard, with the sort of Russian roulette style. There are little moments throughout, and Michelle Monaghan in a relatively small and thankless role as the sort of damsel in distress at various points. She's fantastic.
She is.
She almost has an Emma Stone sort of energy to her, and you think, where could she have gone from here? And now she's relegated to cameo appearances in Mission Impossible movies.
That was one thing that I thought was really sad. I mean, like, it's all like the character she plays is a kind of aspiring actress who doesn't really make it. So, I mean, you know, it almost seems sort of poetic justice in that sense. But
yeah, also Shannon Sossaman, who was also a thing for like for a day and a night, wasn't she?
Gosh. And, of course, I must say, over the end credits, Robert Downey Jr. does the end theme himself in the brief moment where he was a recording artist at the piano.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I don't know if you heard that. Yeah. It's a terrible piece of adult contemporary. Luckily, that has been struck off the record. Oh. If there's a clip, it's fantastic. And then it would be 8 years until Iron Man 3. Shane Black almost back in movie jail for a bit longer because this film wasn't so much of a success.
But I can imagine that. I can imagine him kind of, you know, dropping screenplays down on a desk and then people just thinking, no, too weird. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, I think that the Marvel movies had to get to a certain point before that they could do the kind of deconstruction. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, you know, Iron Man 3 is the kind of, you know, the meta Marvel movie.
Yeah, and very divisive because of that. Yeah,
yes.
With certain fans.
It'll be interesting to see, you know, circling back to Predator, how that's going to play, you know, and how it's going to do. I mean, I'm sure it'll make a ton of money on its opening weekend. But, I mean, again, is that just a little bit too weird of a Predator movie? Is that what people are expecting? Mm-hmm. And, yeah, I'm curious to see how it plays.
Well, we'll see how it plays. Maybe we can talk about it again in a future episode. David, what should we watch for next week? What's our homework? So we have The Little Stranger, Lenny Abramson's new movie, based on Sarah Waters' novel. We have Gaspar Noé, back at it, with Climax. And then Film Club next week is The Big Lebowski for its, gosh, is it
20th anniversary?
You talk about feeling old.
Not on the rug, man.
See? See what happens, Lebowski? You see what happens?
Nobody calls me Lebowski. You got the wrong guy. I'm the dude, man.
Your name's Lebowski. Your wife is Bunny.
My wife, Bunny? Do you see a wedding ring on my finger? Does this place look like I'm married? The toilet seat's up, man.
Woo?
Yeah.
isn't this guy supposed to be a millionaire?
I'm trying to think if that was my first 18 or not at the cinema. It was either that or LA Confidential. Whichever one of those came out first. By that I include, that was like me going to buy the ticket and not being ID'd and being let in and thinking...
Bad Boys.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
Kill Bill Volume 1. So, yeah, dating ourselves there. And so let us know what you think about The Big Lebowski at the usual channels, at LW Lies on Twitter, truthandmovies at tcolondon.com via email or on the lwlies.com/podcast comment section. Any other business, David?
Yeah, just want to give a quick shout out to a screening we're hosting. If you're in the London area on Saturday the 22nd, midday, we are screening Alfred Hitchcock's Dilemma for Murder. Mm-hmm. Wait for it. In 3D.
Whoa.
It's a film that was originally filmed in 3D, and it was right at the end of the kind of late 50s 3D craze, made as a contractual obligation by Hitchcock as well. What a contractual obligation. And it ended up coming out mainly in 2D. A few select screenings in 3D, I think, in the original run, but it's kind of been exhumed in its original form, so we're going to be able to enjoy that, and that's we're doing that in conjunction with MUBI because they have a new season currently of Hitchcock films.
Oh, terrific!
So it's some really nice sort of, you know, slightly more lesser known ones worth sort of.
That central set piece in 3D with the scissors is going to be something on the big screen.
I know. That's at the Rio Cinema in Dalston, and with every ticket, we have created a really cool bespoke Dilemma for Murder print poster by a really talented Spanish illustrator called Lola Beltran. So you can currently see that on our Instagram page if you want to have a look at it. So
check it out. So that's Dilemma for Murder, and this has been Truth and Movies. Thank you, Matt Thrift, for joining me this week.
Thanks
and thank
for
you,
having
David
me.
Jenkins.
Thank you.
I've been Michael Leader, and as always, this has been a 7Digital production.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.